Member-supported Jazz 90.1 proudly welcomes you to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites. Call the show now at 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415 or soundbites.org. Now, alongside Steve Ray and Dave Enright, here's Nick Francesco on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Good afternoon, Mr. and Mrs. American, all the chips in the BC. It is Saturday, the 14th of September, Anno Domini 2013, and you... Oh, you lucky people. You're listening to Soundbites. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Michael Oden.
And in 5 minutes after the hour, we're going to be bringing you news, views, things to choose. Nothing to lose. Kick off your shoes. Don't get the blues. Here comes the news. Apple was all over the news this week. It started with their iPhone announcement, and there were two separate reactions. On the good side, it's a new iPhone. Actually, two of them. The iPhone 5 is the higher-priced one. The iPhone 5S is the higher-priced one. There's a new color, gold. The processor is faster. There's a motion coprocessor. There's a fingerprint scanner. The camera has a dual LED flash, white and amber, to give your photos a more natural color. It also has a larger aperture and a slightly larger sensor in the camera. The battery life is slightly better, 10 hours of talk time, 10 hours of LTE browsing, 250 hours of standby. There are lots of new accessories, including new cases. The iPhone 5C is the cheaper one. The case is plastic. It comes in five croc-inspired colors and has a list of only $99 with contract. It also uses a lower-end processor. On the bad side, there's the reaction of the entire world. Wall Street was very unhappy with the announcement. Apple stock headed for the basement. It lost over 50 points the day of the announcement and is still dropping. Part of their worry is over how expensive the iPhone 5C is. Now, if you were paying attention, you heard me say that the iPhone 5C is $99, but that's with a two-year contract. In China, where many phones are very inexpensive or free, and there are no contract buys, an iPhone 5C will cost $700, which does not help them break into the amazingly lucrative low-end overseas market. The stock price is still well above the recent low of $390, but it sends a very clear message to Apple and particularly to Tim Cook. Apple will also release iOS 7 on the 18th. It's got a new look, much flatter than the old one. It also supports a control panel. Pundits and Wall Street are calling it catch-up. And, of course, that's the problem. Apple is seen as a massively innovative company. So when they come out with something that seems like ketchup, Wall Street punishes them severely. A lot of this comes from the end of the cult of Jobs. Tim Cook is seen as just a normal human, and that makes Wall Street very unhappy. Apple is also making a couple of other moves. iWork will be free, but only for new iOS devices. iTunes Radio will launch on the 18th of September, as will an Apple TV refresh. The only new feature, as far as I can tell, is a tweak to AirPlay. On the other hand, the iWatch is reportedly stalled for major issues. And, of course, people are already talking about security problems with the fingerprint system. So, our poll of the week at soundbites.org, that's bites with a Y, Francis would like us to remind you, is Apple's got new iPhones and stuff. And the choices are, woo, meh, I could not conceivably care less. So far, predictably, I could not conceivably care less, as 18 of the 21 votes, leaving 3 for woohoo and none for meh. But I know you'll have more to say about this because, well, you are who you are. So if you go to the forums, you'll see 14 September 13, Apple's got new iPhones and stuff, where you can put your own personal spin on things. And of course, we'd like to hear from you about what you think of this. So give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Or toll free 1-800-790-0415.
And no matter what Wall Street thinks, they're going to sell a metric bucket load of them.
They absolutely are.
People have already lined up at the New York Apple Store.
Yeah, not understanding that they can't order them yet. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with them. What I'm saying is Wall Street just isn't getting it.
Right. Wall Street is all about growth, and part of the problem is every time Apple comes out with a new iPhone, they sell upgrades to all the old iPhone owners, so they're not necessarily growing the iPhone market. They still sell tens of millions of them a month.
But it's not new market, and that's what Wall Street wants.
Right.
And therefore, while they have some 20% of the worldwide market, that's all they have. They haven't grown that in a very long time, and that's what Wall Street looks at.
Right.
They're not interested in the company itself, how much money it has. The question is, where is it going in the future?
Right.
And they don't see it going anywhere with the current crop of ideas.
Which is interesting, because somebody just paid a couple of months ago over $600,000 to have coffee with Tim Cook to hear his ideas at a charity auction.
And I'm telling you, it's Wall Street against the rest of the world.
Right.
But Wall Street is what counts for investors.
Right.
So it's an interesting issue, and it's a real problem for Apple, and they know it. And they're not, whatever else you may think or not think about Apple, they're not stupid, and they know this is going on. They just haven't figured out how to deal with it yet.
Yeah, and part of the problem is the rumor mill. You know, the old joke is you buy on rumor and sell on fact. So the run up before the event this week, Apple's price jumped quite a bit. And then when the announcement actually came out, the price falls. So that's typical. But all the rumors were the iPhone 5C was going to be the cheap phone.
Right.
No, it's the color phone.
Right.
it's cheaper, but it's not, you know, the free without contract phone or the $100 without contract phone you get in a lot of other countries.
And $700, it's about $600. Discount if you buy it with a two-year contract. And that's about right. You buy an $800 phone, it costs you $200. You buy a $900 phone, it costs you $300.
Yeah.
You buy a $700 phone, it costs you $100.
So, the 5C is $550 without a contract.
Right.
So,
and overseas, that'll be $700.
Right. And so you buy it with your contract, it's $100. In fact, my son at the meeting said, Dad, can you buy me one of those? It's only $100. Okay, yeah, it's the $100 a month for the contract after that I'm worried about.
Exactly. And that's the problem overseas. There are no contracts in places like Japan and China.
Yep. And most of Europe.
So if you're going to buy an iPhone 5C, you will pay the full price, which is about $700. By the time it gets there, and they have all the VATs and tariffs and whatever they are.
The irony is that they're made in China.
Yeah.
So they get all shipped over here, and they get all shipped all the way back again.
But so the whole point behind the cheaper phone was that one of the reasons that Wall Street feels that Android is eating Apple's lunch is because while Apple has a large percentage of the United States, they have really a fairly minuscule percentage of the rest of the world. And Android has all of that.
Yep.
Really, Apple only has about a 20% market share. And 99%, because who else is left?
Yeah.
BlackBerry and the Windows phone? No. It's about 78% Android. And that's because you can buy a truly $99 Android phone.
Yeah.
Overseas.
What's interesting is when you compare handset market share versus after the sale revenue, Apple is killing everybody. More people buy more things on the fewer iPhones than they do on Android.
Right.
So Wall Street wants to see that initial, you know, stock price, and Apple saying, yeah, we're okay with making $10 billion a month.
Yeah, they don't. Yeah. Okay, we can live with this.
Yeah.
But the problem for Wall Street is they also look at the fact that when you say Apple has sold 100 gazillion iPhones, it's all into the same market. They cannibalize their own market. And so, consequently, from Wall Street's point of view, that's a very bad thing.
Yeah.
And so that's why the stock price keeps dropping and dropping and dropping. But there were a lot of interesting things in this announcement. Again, Apple's not going to get any credit for that because, you know.
And they're getting some anger.
They're getting a lot of anger. But there are a lot of interesting things. The new iOS 7. But part of the problem is there were interesting things, but again, not revolutionary things. Mm-hmm. iOS 7 is an evolution, and there isn't much of it there. The iPhone 5 series, again, it's an evolution. There's not much there's no revolution and there's not much evolution. It's a faster processor. Well, everybody comes out with a faster processor. It's a little more RAM. Everybody comes out with a little more RAM. It's a different color. Who cares?
64-bit. They say it's the first phone to have 64-bit. And then Samsung popped out. Yeah, our next one will too.
Yeah, but the rest of the world is saying, I don't care.
Yep.
I actually don't care. The only reason you need 64-bit is if you're going to go over 2 terabytes.
Right. But it does make the internals easier with the co-development of 64-bit macOS.
Right.
So that helps them.
Doesn't help me, right. So I don't care.
Well, theoretically, it makes the programmers happier to make us better programs.
But until we see that, I don't care.
I got an interesting kick out of the motion coprocessor that's in it. We used to talk about floating point coprocessors and how important they were. But now math is so easy.
Yeah, right.
The main chips can do math so fast.
And most of them don't do a lot of math.
Right. It's now all, it's motion. It's sensing that the phone is moving. In fact, I was watching a Top Gear episode, and it was a train versus car challenge. They were going to a soccer game in Milan. and so they're on the train with his phone, and the accelerometer on the phone says we're doing 170 miles an hour. The phone is motionless to the train.
Yeah.
How did it know?
It may not have been an accelerometer. It may have been using the GPS system.
Yeah.
But at any rate, the reality is that this motion coprocessor is a big deal. Considering what it will allow you in the future to do. But because Apple's not teaching us what that means, most people look at it and go, eh.
Yeah. Again, that's something the developers will take advantage of and will get better apps in the future.
Right, right, right. But right now, it's who cares.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem is, because of that, by the time the developers are used to a motion sensor, by the time the motion coprocessor, by the time developers are used to 64-bit, Android phones will have those things too, and it won't seem like a big deal when the apps come out.
Right.
So that's part of the problem that Apple has had. They bring out innovative stuff, but they haven't followed through. They don't take advantage of it early enough to put them out in front.
Yeah.
And that's happened several times now.
And part of that is Apple's once a year upgrade plan.
Right.
Where most of the other phone companies are once a quarter, something new comes out. And that's kind of the problem in the Android world is... You know, I just bought the hot new HTC One. Okay, it's not the hot new phone anymore. So you have less time to have the hot new phone, at least in the Apple world. Although, I still run into a lot of people, you know, normal everyday people who don't realize the iPhone is on a one-year cycle. And so, I just bought an iPhone 5 2 weeks ago. Everybody knew that there was a new phone coming in September.
Except that person.
Except everybody that's not an Apple watcher.
Right, 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 right. So that's part of the issue. Apple, while they continue to be innovative, one of the things that Steve Jobs did so well was not just innovate. They have a lot of innovative people at Apple, but he sold it. He sold the innovation.
He was the and that was the partnership in the very beginning. Woz was the engineer and Jobs was the marketer. He could convince you needed it. In fact, there's a classic line in his biography. Someone asked him about focus groups when they're designing products. And he said, we don't do focus groups. People don't know what they want until I tell them.
He's right, actually.
Yeah, we didn't know we wanted a pocket iPad. iPod. We didn't know we wanted a smartphone.
Right, right. You bring those things to a focus group, and they go, I never thought about it.
Yeah, the ones that existed before, and Apple didn't actually invent the MP3 player or invent the smartphone, but they took what other companies had done, and Jobs figured out how to make it better.
Yep.
And that's sort of find a niche, fill the niche.
Yeah, exactly.
And now it's not. But it's now, a huge niche now.
Now nobody's selling that find that they made.
Right. They need to bring back the evangelist program, we think.
That's exactly right. All right, back to the phones. Our first caller. Back to the phones. To the phones. Our first caller is Bodan from Rochester, New York. Hiya, Bodan. What's up?
Hi, Nicholas and gentlemen. Got Two questions. I don't know if it's my computer or the monitor. Very intermittently, when I turn on my computer and monitor, and this is after it's been off for at least a day or two, the desktop doesn't load right. The resolution changes for some reason. I have to restart the computer. Right now, I'm running. I have a 20-inch wide Samsung. The resolution is set at 1680 by 1050. But this morning, when I turned on my computer from a cold start, the screen came up 1064 by 768. And I don't know if that's the graphics card inside my computer or if it's the monitor itself or something.
Well, it could be either.
Or it could be the battery in the computer not remembering your settings.
Right.
Also, the battery may have to be changed.
Right. You may have to change the battery. I would do that first because it's cheapest.
Got it. And the other thing is, I've danced at Security Tango, usually dance at her maybe twice a month, and other than tracking cookies, it comes up clean. I also have another program called CCleaner, which I think does a very good job of removing cookies and stuff like that, files and stuff like that. Can a browser like Chrome get infected or somehow get a little... what I'm going to say is that sometimes I'll go to a website where there's a pop-up or pop-under, and I have the pop-up blocker up, but then all of a sudden the pop-under, I know something is there, but when I go to that same website, like in the Mozilla, I will see a new page open up, so I know that there's something like a pop-under is there, but I don't see it in Chrome.
Right.
And I reset the default settings in Chrome.
Well, it's not a default setting. But there is a setting in Chrome that says open new windows in a new tab.
Uh-huh.
And when you set that, those sorts of things will almost always open in a new tab.
Instead of a new window.
But you have to set that. And it's probably set by default in Mozilla and not set by default in Chrome.
So if I go, would that be under the... privacy settings, or would that be? Do you have Chrome open up right now? I'm sitting in front of my computer.
Yeah.
It's in the tab settings in Safari.
You can find it because there's a great search thing there. Now you can find it. Listen, I'll look for it. I'll find it. We probably have to take a break.
Okay.
But I'll look for it during the break.
All right, thank you, guys.
All right, thanks. We are going to take a quick break, but we'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Steve Ray, Michael Odom, Nina Francesco, and you. It is 22 minutes after the hour. You are listening to the longest-running computer show in the known universe, hurtling headlong through our 25th year on the air. It's Soundbites, right here on the truly great and truly member-supported Jazz 90.1. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Michael Odin.
And at 27 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites. And to answer Bodan's question... Is he still on? No, he's not still online.
In Firefox, it is in preferences under tabs. There's a checkbox that says open in new windows instead of a tab. I don't know if that's default or not because I've been messing with my settings too, and Nick is trying to find it in Chrome.
In Chrome, it's actually an extension.
Yeah.
And there are several that do it. But you need to do that. There's also one...
Well, if it's an extension, then he wouldn't have it by default.
Right. That's exactly right. He'd need to install it. So you can go into the Chrome store and look for extensions. Of course, you get to the Chrome store by opening a new tab, unless you've added some interesting toy to it somewhere. The first apps screen should have the store on it. And that would let you download that and install it. So that's how that works. All right, back to the news. There was a lot of good news this week. And, of course, I picked the clunkers of the good news. Facebook knows what you talk about, just like Twitter. But its edge is that it also knows who you are. Facebook's newest APIs let select news outlets view, search, and see your public posts. Plus, it tallies keyword mentions and collects the demographic data of everyone mentioning certain keywords. But Facebook has confirmed that we see the potential for these tools to be really useful down the line for brands and agencies that will definitely come in the coming weeks. It's all started with Facebook Lexicon, built by Roddy Lindsay, one of Facebook's early data scientists. Lexicon launched to little fanfare back in 2008 and let you see the relative frequency of how often different keywords appeared in wall posts. Similar to Google Trends, you couldn't see the actual number of times people mentioned, say, Iraq, but could see how popular the term was and how it waxed and waned. The vision of our collective opinion was kind of stunning, actually. Less than 2 years later, Facebook had shut it down, and Lindsay quietly left the company. But the essence of his work was revived Monday as Facebook announced the launch of the Public Feed API and Keyword Insights API and gave access to BuzzFeed, CNN, NBC's Today Show, BSkyB, Slate, and analytics firm Mass Relevance. The Public Feed API lets these companies search for a word and see a fire hose of public posts that mention it. The Keyword Insights API, meanwhile, shows how many people mention a word in both public and private posts during a set time frame, and shows a demographic breakdown of the age, gender, and location of these people. To be clear, the Public Feed and Keyword Insights APIs fully respect your privacy settings, because this is Facebook.
Respects it. Respects the privacy settings to the minimum, to the maximum that our shareholders will allow.
Yeah, exactly.
We respect them, but we probably ignore them.
We ignore them, but we respect that you have them. That's nice for you. If you set a post to public, then news outlets and eventually marketers can see it through the API just the same way anyone else in the world could. The Keyword Insights API does tap private data, but in a totally anonymized way, it says here. The only it only provides tallies of the total number of mentions of a certain word there have been in public and private posts during a certain time period. No one sees the actual content of your private posts, and your name is never connected to your anonymized demographic data. And, of course, I have a bridge to sell you, so give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299, toll-free 1-800-790-0415. Where'd that 6 come from? I don't know. Let me do that again. 585, and I'm looking, I can look right at it. They're right on the wall here. 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 1-800-790-0415.
And we just had a very interesting discussion at Cider, the Apple Cider Users Group last week on privacy and security.
That guy was brilliant.
Yeah.
He was brilliant.
There were some complaints afterward about how brilliant he was. No.
Yeah, sure there were.
And that was probably the one of the biggest points that caught most people unaware, is that there is no privacy on Facebook. Anyone determined enough can get in and see private posts.
Yeah, there's a lot of the HR companies nowadays, when they go to hire someone, they go look at what you do on Facebook. They not only look at your public posts, but they also look at your private posts. There are two ways you can do that. You can pay Facebook for that privilege if you can prove you're an HR company, I believe, I'm given to understand. But most people don't bother because it's easy enough to break in. Their security is non-existent. And so they can go look at your private posts and determine whether or not they want to hire you.
The thing is, everybody seems to assume that whatever they put on the internet on a site like that is private. I can tell you right now, basically none of it is.
None of it is.
If it's on the internet, it's in the public eye. On the internet, it's in the public eye. If you don't want anybody knowing about it, don't post it. Just don't post it.
They may say it's private, and it can either accidentally leak and become public, or people can get to it.
People can get to it.
Yeah.
The other part of the problem is not everything on Facebook about you is yours.
Yep.
So if you're at a party and somebody takes a picture and posts it on Facebook,
it's theirs.
It's theirs, and they've posted it in a public place.
Well, it says right in the privacy notice, if you read it, that once you post a photo on this site, it's our property. We can do what we want with it. So if we want to send it to wherever for data mining or whatever, they can do it.
Are you telling me you actually read the terms of service?
I have a lot of time on my hands.
Well, clearly,
yeah.
I have
a lot of time on my hands.
Most people don't.
What's interesting is that type of clause is necessary to share the photos with people you want to share them to. But it also means they can share the photo with anyone. So the bottom line is, you give us your photo, we can share it with anyone, including advertisers, including these guys, including those guys, because
that
has to be there. And that's why I know a lot of people that won't use Facebook.
Right. Oh, it's .org. TOSDR.org. Terms of service didn't read. .org. my favorite part of this is, I have read and agreed to the terms is the biggest lie on the web. We aim to fix that. And what they have is a browser add-on that you can download that talks to you about what your rights online are. And they rate them as to you know, how good or bad or whatever.
Does this one translate the legalese to plain English?
Well, it rates it in terms of the various stuff. So, for example, if you were to go to, for example, Time, you would see that they have it's basically a rating service, and they rate how secure it is. It's very cool, actually. Then they grade them from class A to class E. Very good to very bad. Facebook has no class. YouTube is D. Google is C. Most places don't have a class yet because this thing just started.
Brand new. Is anybody a B or an A? Yeah, too many.
SoundCloud is a B. GitHub is a B.
Class E. Oh, my goodness.
TwitPic, yeah. Yeah,
well, I would have guessed it.
The purpose of TwitPic is to share pictures.
Yeah, DuckDuckGo is Class A.
Wow.
So there's a bunch of them on there, and you should take a look at them. And basically, as you can see, what it says is, here's what they say they're doing, and how well do they do it. So you'll see they've got a lot of places that they're working on. But they haven't, you know, it's a brand new site, so they're adding stuff all the time. They're farther along than they were last time I looked, so clearly they're still working on it. It's a very cool idea. We'll see how well, and of course you can donate to them. And it's a very cool site. That's TOSDR.org, and I'm sure Steve will put it up.
Yep.
Terms of service didn't read. Very funny, very clever.
I remember a few years ago, there was a British web store, and right around Christmas time, they had a checkbox in their checkout program, and I agree give my firstborn son to the devil. And 99% of the people clicked agree.
Yep.
And then as another experiment, they added an extra pound. Just because we felt like it, I think, was the text, and most people agreed.
Yeah.
No one reads that fine print or the fine service. So, well, you know, just that's an easy way to make extra dollars.
We have been trained to simply click OK. Microsoft really has been the big one that trains us to do that, but they all do it. Apple does it. Linux does it. You see something come up on the screen. Do you want to do this? OK, get out of my way. I'm doing something more important.
I'm doing something else,
And so,
are you sure? At least Apple has. Are you sure?
Apple has an "Are you sure?" If you click too fast, there should always be an "Are you sure?" that comes up.
Yeah, I have seen a couple of those that did that. A lot of times, the terms of service, you can't click agree until you scroll to the bottom,
right?
Which implies that you read it. But I have seen a couple of them that said that was pretty fast. Are you sure? You really read that 6,000 document or page document fast?
Right. I have a friend who religiously, because most of them you can also save it. So he religiously saves everything and has never gone back to read any of them. But at least he saved them. So they're on his drive somewhere. You know, if he ever finds as much time on his hands as Michael has, or he gets smart as Michael is, then he will go and read them. But yeah, it's you should really always read the terms of service. They will scare the heck out of you.
I remember, I think it was DBase version 1.
Yeah.
Had the license agreement that came up. that you had to click agree to use the program. If you left it alone for, you know, a minute, it continued anyway.
Yeah.
I never agreed to the license, and I used it all the time.
Yep. Well, what's interesting is this is not limited to, I mean, it didn't start with computers.
Yeah.
Western Union, on the back of their form, mm-hmm. if you read it, it basically said they may or may not make anywhere from one attempt up yeah. to deliver your telegram.
Yeah. It's like plane tickets. Read the back of your plane ticket. You don't, yeah. It doesn't guarantee a seat. In fact, I just right. had a friend who...
It not only doesn't guarantee a seat, it doesn't guarantee you'll go anywhere.
Yeah. had a friend who was trying to fly home, and you know, you're supposed to get to the airport 2 hours early. Well, she got there 2.5 hours early, and they said, oh, you weren't here, so we gave your seat away. No, I got here earlier than I was supposed to.
Yep.
Too bad. We gave your seat away.
Yeah. All right. We're going to take a short intermission here. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Steve Ray, Michael Oden, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It is 40 minutes after the hour, and you're listening to the longest-running computer show in the known universe. Yes, it's still Soundbites. And yes, we're right here on the truly great and truly member-supported Jazz 90.1. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Michael Oden.
And at 43 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites, and we have Larry from Fairport on the line. Hi, Larry. What's up?
Oh, hi. Listen to your show often and pretty
Thank
much
you.
Enjoy it. I have what could be a simple question, and that involves iTunes on a Mac. I'm running iTunes 10.x on a desktop iMac 2008 10.68. So what happened is I signed up for iTunes Match, and most of my songs matched, which is good. But instead of having 1,000 songs, I now have 2,000 songs. And when I arrange them by artist, for example, or song title, they play twice. And I want to know how not to have it do that, because I like all my songs, but I don't want to hear twice in a row.
Right. One of the things iTunes Match can do mm-hmm. is it will download higher quality versions of your songs.
Mm-hmm.
In the early days of MP3 ripping, we were all doing 128-bit mm-hmm. MP3s. All the songs now on Apple Store are 256K AAC, so they're much better quality.
Right.
So what iTunes Match will do is download those updated versions for you. Sometimes it leaves the MP3s as well. And I'm scanning here to see if I can find exactly where you fix this. One of the things you can do is in iTunes, there's a I think it's in the view menu, you can turn on the kind column, and it will tell you whether that kind is an MP3 or an AAC. And that will help you delete your duplicate songs.
Right.
There's also a couple of Apple scripts. There's a guy called Doug, and he's got Doug's Apple scripts.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got lots and lots of really great automation tools for finding and matching iTunes duplicates. But I'm scanning around here, it looks like this isn't an uncommon problem.
Yeah, because when you go under the store section of the menu, it has turn iTunes match on and off, update
yeah.
iTunes match, et cetera, et cetera. And that's all well and good, and it's nice to be able to download a higher quality sound. But it says down at the bottom in iTunes that instead of 1,000 tunes, I have 2,000 tunes. When I go to the iTunes music folder,
mm-hmm.
there's only 1,000 tunes in it. And I don't know why it's telling me there's twice as many.
It's probably showing you iTunes in the cloud. I shouldn't do that, too. Because the other feature of iTunes Match is iTunes in the cloud.
Yeah.
So if you don't have the physical file on your computer, you can still download it again. So that's sort of, right. sort of designed for phones with limited storage space. One of the tips that I'm finding here is turn off iTunes Match
mm-hmm.
And then turn it back on again.
Mm-hmm.
And it will either fix the problem or triplicate them.
Perfect. Good to know. Well, you got a 50-50
right.
shot.
A much yeah. larger music
yeah.
collection.
Yeah. Well, there's also in iTunes, there's the show duplicates command.
Yeah.
That will find duplicates.
Yeah, but are they duplicates if they have different bit rates.
Well, what I've done is I've clicked on that column that has the little cloud-type icon and sorted it that way, and that forces it to only play the song one time because all the ones that are in the cloud are at the top, for example.
Right, yeah. So
and
that sorts
the other ones that are matched, or whatever the term is, are in sequence. And then there's other ones that say error, which is okay, but they still play. I mean, they didn't disappear from the hard drive. You know, it took like something like 3 or 4 days for it to all get matched in the cloud when I first signed up for iTunes Match.
Yeah, that's typically what we see. Although with only, well, like I say, only 1,000 songs, it's that's not a very big library. Yeah. Most of the time, we're hearing about these problems with 10,000 or 15,000 songs, and there's a 25,000 song limit to iTunes Match that some people have run into and are very annoyed by it.
Well, right. If you've got 15,000 songs and you double them, you've beaten the limit.
Yeah.
Yep, exactly. And the only thing is, the reason I'm calling is that when I sort and I listen to various artists, it'll play their songs twice. And like I say, I like the songs, but I don't want to hear them twice in a row.
Not that much.
And the only way that, and the only way I can figure out to do that is to click the one little column that says, you know, that has the cloud icon and just sort them that way and just start it.
That's the cloud. Yeah, the cloud version versus your local version.
Yeah, and I want to hide the cloud version. Is there a way of doing that?
Yeah, there is. I think that's also in the view menu to don't show music in the cloud.
I'm looking at it, and let's see, view options.
Well, you said you're running iTunes 10. You might want to upgrade to 11.
Yeah.
I was trying to see what the system requirements were for iTunes 11 also.
I'm running iTunes 10.7, iteration 21. Little about thing, guys.
Let's see here. Yeah, the current version is 11.0.5, revision 5. I don't have iTunes Match turned on, so it's not, I don't get that option to hide in the cloud.
All right. And I have a laptop and a iPad. I haven't yet turned on iTunes Match on those to see what I can get, because those have absolutely no songs on them. They would have to draw it from the cloud.
Right.
So maybe I'll turn those on and see what, you know, what the status is.
Yeah, you can upgrade to iTunes 11 with 10.6, so you might want to try that. I'd back up your, well, it's too late now. Back up your library before you do anything more, so you can at least get back to only duplicates if they happen to triplicate.
Yeah,
but that's what I hear, and I've heard a lot of people talking about with iTunes Match, things messed up like that. Turn it off and log out of your iTunes account, and then log back in, turn it on, and let it rematch.
Yeah, that's probably a good thing to do, because it's nice being able to get the higher quality. But you know, if I don't want to listen to things twice,
right? And then if you sort by kind or sort by bit rate, then the higher the bit rate's the higher quality. Then sort by bit rate and then delete the lower bit rate versions. Yeah.
Okay, that's a good idea. Okay, good. Thanks for the information.
Sure.
Okay. Bye bye.
Yep. We joked that the iTunes Match is $25 a year, and that will take music that you ripped from CD and put it in Apple's cloud, so then you can listen to it on any device. And we jokingly called that the piracy amnesty.
Yeah.
So it doesn't know you ripped them from a CD you bought. Just any music you have in your library that's not already sold, but that you didn't buy from Apple. See, any music you bought from Apple, you can sync to all your devices automatically and download them again at no charge. But music you didn't buy from Apple, so a lot of people had huge music libraries before Apple started selling music. And what's kind of nice at Apple's end is if you do have a song that they also sell, they don't upload your version because they already have a copy. So that saves disk space at their end. And it's nice, as I mentioned, that they let you download the higher quality version because we now have so much bigger hard drives, we can go with 256-bit AC rather than the old 128 MP3.
I have this weird thing going on with Google Music, which is a very similar idea. And I'm finding music that I don't remember buying...
other members of your household?
It must be. It must be that either Elaine or Amelia are buying this music, or at least have this music.
Where'd this come from?
Yeah. Exactly.
Oh, is it one of those free songs of the day or whatever?
I certainly get a lot of the free song of the days.
Yeah.
Days, free songs of the day.
Yeah.
And some of them are pretty nifty. Some of them are, yeah, I don't care.
Yeah, if you have that like turned down to automatically download, you can fill your library with real crap.
Well,
in your mind.
It's magnificent music, of course, yes. Just not to my taste.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of that stuff out there.
Oh, here, Doug's Apple Script has a specific one for iTunes Match duplications.
There you go.
I'll post that.
He'll post that.
This so guy, Doug, is a heck of a guy.
That'll help Larry.
Yep.
Yeah, and that's one of the really nice things about Apple Script is that it's very powerful. And if you know what you're doing, or you can find Doug, some amazing things you can do with
it's a fairly easy English language scripting language. So it's pretty easy to learn. It's one of those things people don't realize is in their Mac. You have a full scripting language with Apple Script, and then Automator can automate functions that Apple Script doesn't do, and then you can mix and match them together. So there's this really powerful programming that you get free with your Mac.
I have a friend who has a Mac who she was saying, I found IFTTT, if this, then that. It's a website that lets you, you know, if something happens, then do this. And she's saying, I've been looking for something like that forever. I said, but you have a Mac. You have Automator. You've had that since the day you bought that Mac.
Yep.
But you're right. People don't know what it is. They don't know what Apple Script is. And people don't program anymore. Yeah. I blame Apple and Microsoft for that. They used to give us programming languages. We had BASIC.
Yep.
And whether you like or don't like BASIC, I don't really care. The point is, it meant that every person who bought a computer had a programming language in their hands.
Because there were no other programs. You had to write them.
To defend them just a little bit, if society has gotten a lot simpler and that we want things done for us and completely done for us, and it probably, and like Apple and Microsoft probably looked at that and went, do we really want to spend all the money to do this when people don't really want it? Or should we just stick it in at the beginning and then, oh, well. And then if they have problems, they come back to us. We can make even more money.
Well, Apple and Microsoft have plenty of things that they've said we don't support, but here you go. And so that could be done. But the other thing is Apple had probably the finest beginner's programming system on the face of this planet in a product called HyperCard, which they just simply killed.
And some of the early proponents of HyperCard inside of Apple refused to work on the computers unless they were allowed to put HyperCard on it. Bill Atkinson and some of the other early guys. But I think a lot of that was in the early times. There were very few other programs to use, so people had to write their own. And in the intervening 20 years, so many programs are out there, you don't need to write your own because you can find one. But now we're running back into that make community. We're making things,
people
physical things,
to.
Programming things, Kickstarter projects, MakerBot. Maker just announced a 3D scanner that's, I think it's less than $1,000, but it's less than the $50,000 that a 3D scanner used to be to laser. So we were talking about the MacGyver bot with the Raspberry Pi attacking an Arduino, and everyone looks at us like we're talking a funny language, but we are. But yeah, you can make your own 3D printer, relatively inexpensive. You can buy a 3D printer now for like $500, fully assembled. But half the fun of it was making it yourself. The Interlock group down on in the Hunkerford building, they meet several times a week, and they have open houses to show people how to do 3D printing.
Yeah, if you want to go see an actual 3D printer, check these folks out because they do some very cool stuff. Do we have time to go to the phones?
Possibly, yes.
We get the question.
Okay, we can at least the question in, and it's our friend Linda from Greece, New York. Hi, Linda, what's up?
Hi, quick question. I have Google All Access Music, but I also have credits on my Android phone. Okay, I just want to use my credit card for the All Access Music, but I don't know if I'm explaining it right.
So you do not want to use the credits.
Every time I buy something, it goes to my credit card.
So you don't want to use the credits you have for Google All Access?
I can't. She doesn't want
to use your credit card, wants to use the credit.
All right, let me, I don't know. I will look that up.
Because you know, it's $9 a month, which is not a big deal, but I've also got $51 in credits, but every time I buy something, it automatically goes to my credit card. It doesn't take away from the credits I've got on there.
Where did you get those credits from?
I got it as a redemption card as a gift.
To Google Music.
Yeah, it was a Google Play. It's a Google Play card, you know.
Yeah.
My credits, I got that for my birthday, but I also want to subscribe.
You
to
may
All Access Music.
Yeah.
For $10 a month. But every time I want to buy something besides that, the automatic take it off my credit card and not my credit.
You may have to go into your Google account and remove the credit card from your account.
But I do this, then the following month, I have to put the credit card. So in other words, put the credit card in, pay for that month, take it off, and do it every month?
Well, take the credit card off, and then when the bill comes due, there should be a way to use the credit on the account rather than a credit card.
I've tried
it,
and I've even called Google, and they said because it's a monthly subscription, you cannot use your credit.
Oh.
Only use a credit card.
Then there you are.
So you can use those credits to buy other things, but not a subscription service.
Uh-huh. Right. So in other words,
fine
I have
print.
To put it in every month as soon as it does. So every month I have to take it off, put it on, take it off, put it on. And that's becoming a pain in the you-know-what.
Neck.
Yeah. Yes.
Yes. If Google has told you that you cannot pay for it with a credit card, then I suspect there's no way around that.
No, I cannot use it, my Google Play credits.
Right, that's what I mean. Oh, that's what I meant. Yeah. If Google has told you can't do that, then
it's
probably you can't
thing.
Do that.
It's like Apple does something similar. There's the Apple Store gift cards that are silver, and then there's the Apple iTunes Store, and they're completely separate, and they don't talk to each other, and you can't use the one credit on the other store. So
yeah,
the physical store and the electronic store, they separate. But Google is all electronic. What should they care?
Yeah. But see, I bought a movie, and I thought it would take it from my credits. It charges
right.
it to my credit card.
Right. I understand what you're saying, but what it sounds like is that Google. I'll look into this, but it sounds like Google just isn't doing that right now. But I'll look into it for you.
Okay, thank you very much, guys.
Yep. All right, we are going to take a slightly longer break. You have managed to hang in there by your fingernails for an entire hour, but for those of you who just have not managed. To be sick of us, we'll be back for a whole nother hour of the longest running computer show in the known universe. It's Soundbites. I'm member supported Jazz 90.1.
Soundbites on member supported Jazz 90.1. Get online now. Call 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415. Or submit your question by email at soundbites.org. Once again, here's Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Michael Oden.
And starting our second hour of Soundbites this week, it is 5 minutes after the hour. And here we go. And yeah, we did look this up, and it kind of makes sense, Linda, that Google wouldn't let you use Google Play to pay for All Access because it is a monthly subscription, and they want to make sure that you're actually going to pay for it every month. And
yeah,
to do that, you would want to have a credit card.
If you go to the Play Store and buy a movie or a song outright, then you can use your Play credit.
Right.
But if you get it as part of your All Access subscription, then you can't.
Apparently, they're just linking the All Access subscription with your credit card and not linking at all
right.
with your Play Store money.
That may change in the future, but we don't know.
Right. All right. Apple, by the way, is now requiring that all users booking a Genius Bar appointment online sign in with an Apple ID. Previously, users could instead fill out a form with name, address, and email in order to book an appointment. When you visit Apple's online Genius Bar appointment page now, you'll be prompted to enter your Apple ID and password in order to confirm it. The reasons for this are manifold, but there is an ongoing effort to tie in a user's Apple ID with all of their actions in Apple's ecosystem. This new procedure is in place for Genius Bar and workshop appointments, and there is now a profile page that allows you to see all of your appointments, past and present. The Apple ID is quickly becoming a core piece of Apple's purchasing experience, inside and out of the Apple retail stores. Apple is introducing the Touch ID fingerprint scanner on the iPhone 5S, which can act as an Apple ID in order to make purchases on the iTunes Store, for instance. An additional reason for this change purports to be to give control of a Genius Bar appointment to a user directly, who must know their credentials and enter them before being allowed to confirm a payment. There is also the convenience of having a customer's data automatically filled out with a simple entry of the Apple ID. This could allow geniuses to look at past purchases and communicate with the users much easier now as well. There also is an outside chance, likely a small one, that having someone sign in with an Apple ID might make them more reluctant to drop an appointment than if they entered info casually, reducing no-shows at the bar. Apple customers can currently make Genius Bar appointments online on Apple's site or in the Apple Store app. This would also theoretically prevent scalping issues like the ones that were reported sporadically in China. Will you be willing to use your Apple ID as a Genius appointment? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 1-800-790-0415. Go ahead.
I say we hear some interesting stories about the Genius Bar. One of the things that people run into with Genius Bar is you have to make an appointment to see the Genius. You can't just walk in most of the time. So this is, you know, you have to, and you have,
I'd pay to see a Genius.
Yeah,
and if it was like Albert Einstein,
you have to go online to sign up for an appointment. Well, if your computer's not working, how do you do that?
Yeah.
Use someone else's computer. But the other thing that we run into a lot is the Apple Store only works on current computers, and they define that as less than 3 years old.
Right.
So we actually had a customer come into our store this week where he waited a week for his Apple Store appointment. He gets there, and they say, oh, no, your computer's too old. We can't look at it.
Genius!
Yeah. And he said, well, you had all my computer information when I signed up for... Right. The appointment. Why didn't you tell me then? Why did you make me wait a week? And all he needed was a new AC adapter. Poor guy. His computer wouldn't turn on because his AC adapter wasn't charging. And well, so it's in retrospect, it was a simple program that, Joey, 10 seconds at the Genius Bar should have fixed it, but they won't look at it because it's old.
Genius.
Genius, yeah. So actually, the weird thing is that the Apple Genius Bar will send people to us at our store for old computers. We won't send people to them. No, sorry.
Because you're geniuses.
Because we're the genius. There are some things the Apple Store can do. We get a lot of annoying problems that people have with iPhones, especially. Apple considers them a consumer device, and they will not let us repair iPhones. The consumer is supposed to go online and fill out the forms.
Nice.
Genius. Thank you, Apple. See, that's the different departments inside Apple. It's like we're doing the different Google Play and Google Access.
Right.
The Apple retail store is a different channel than the Apple dealer channel, and they don't talk to each other.
Genius.
Genius.
All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Steve from Rochester, New York. Welcome, Steve. What's up?
Well, just listening to what you were saying about programming, I remember HyperCard from my college days at Geneseo back in 1989 and Pascal programming.
Yep.
That's besides. I wanted to ask you a question more recently. I use a lot of open source software. I have an older computer. I'm not even on the internet, but I do a lot of artwork and graphics. I'm getting into Blender, the program.
Oh, yeah.
Blender. Maybe you could help me out with this. I was talking with somebody that's fairly up to date on what's going on RIT right now in the program, and he was telling me that that program that you use with that Python is becoming obsolete. Now, I'd like to ask you this question. Would it be worth my time to get into that, and how difficult would that be to learn that program? I started just a little bit of the basics with a couple of Blender books, but I'm wondering, is this thing on its way out? And the way Blender constantly changes its interface so fast, you know, and also I see Python directly related to a lot of open source software like GIMP and even some of that Inkscape and that.
Let me make a suggestion, Steve.
Yeah.
If you ever go to a group of people who are open source advocates and say Python is obsolete, I would make sure I were wearing a suit of armor and had many loaded firearms with me.
Well, because you're supposed to use Ruby now, right?
Yeah. You're supposed to use Ruby. Yeah, that'll happen.
No, it isn't on its way out.
No, it really isn't. It here's the deal.
People still use C.
Every single program, every single programming language, rather, has at some point been the darling of the week. And the minute a new darling of the week comes in, the old darling of the week is now an obsolete pile of junk. But it's not.
Except for the millions of people using it.
Python is still being used by an astounding number of people to do some really amazing stuff. And there's no point at which learning a programming language is wasted. So my suggestion is if you went to, python.org,
yep.
You will find a vibrant and living community of Python users.
And Python is another language that comes with the Mac.
Yeah.
Yep.
Oh, does it?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Well, it's a Linux thing. You have Python on any Linux derivative. You also have Python in the Mac because the Mach 10 kernel comes with it.
They're cousins.
They're cousins.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, there are thousands of books. There's probably a local Python users group, I suspect.
Yeah, I've seen they've introduced some of it in some of these Blender books, just the basic beginning parts. But people have warned me. Some
very
people, I don't know. Thanks for this information. That's really helpful because I was wondering, you know, sometimes it would be worth wasting all your time. You spend all of it, and then next updated version of Blender and all these other programs will be gone or something will be using something else.
Well, the interesting thing there is that all of those programs written in that language will need somebody to maintain them. You can still make a living with COBOL because of all the millions of programs written in COBOL that no one remembers how to program for.
Back in the, do you remember the Y2K bug that was going to take down the entire universe? A friend of mine had been a COBOL programmer and had retired. And they asked him to come out of retirement to fix the COBOL programs. He quoted them a price, and they jumped at it. They asked him to do more. He doubled his price. They jumped at it. He doubled his price again. They jumped at it. By the time he was done, he was saying, I have made more money in the last year than I made in my last 5 years of working. And all I did was go in and change variables.
Yep.
That was COBOL. So yeah, there is a local Python users group, rockpy.org, rockpy.org.
I was trying to make sure that was Rochester, New York.
Oh, that's a very good question.
I don't see where the meetings are. Just that they are.
Yeah, well, I went to Google and searched for Python Users Group Rochester, New York.
Bausch & Lomb Hall at U of R.
There you go. So, yeah, check that out, and they'll tell you where they are and what they're doing and what's going on. And I guarantee you will find a vibrant and living community.
All right, thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
All right, good luck. Have fun.
That's the one interesting problem of living in a city that has the same name as so many other, especially Rochester, Minnesota, with the Mayo Clinic.
Well, and that's people from New York who moved, who traveled west on the Conestoga wagons or whatever they used. Blender, for those of you who don't know, is a pretty nifty piece of technology. Actually, it's an open source platform. It's a suite of tools, really, for creating 3D graphics. For creating 3D everything. So if you've ever seen Big Buck Bunny or any of those other movies,
probably
they were created in Blender.
3D printers.
Probably it is. In fact, I know it is. So it's a piece of software. It's a 3D computer graphics software, mostly for animation, visual effects, 3D printed models, stuff like that. And you can do some. And it's got a scripting language, which, oh, by the way, is Python. And so you can actually script stuff to happen without having to do it by hand. And all you have to do is know a little bit of Python. And Python's a pretty easy language. I mean, honestly, it's like a thousand other languages. It's all about dialects as opposed to what the program itself is in any way different. So, yeah, I would say you can't lose learning Python. And it's just one more language under your belt, which is never a bad thing.
I tried to do that in college. I could speak six languages, only one human language.
Yeah, right.
They didn't count that. They made me take a human language.
I have a friend who picked up computer languages like that. And I asked him, how do you do that? And he says, look, computers only do one thing. This is just a different dialect telling it how to do that thing.
Really, really fast.
And I thought, God bless you that your brain works that way.
See, I've always thought that's helped me fix computers now in my profession because I learned how to program. I know how they're supposed to work. And I can figure out when they're not working. Although it does hurt me sometimes that I'm too logical.
Yeah, right.
If this, then else, you know?
Right. Well, and troubleshooting is really a separate skill that we also don't teach anymore. And it's something that we really should teach. If you know how something is supposed to work, then you should be able to troubleshoot where the problem is.
$20,001. $20,000 right. for knowing the machine and $1 for the little chalk outline circling the problem.
Exactly. Well, it's like Bodin's problem at the very beginning. Intermittently, his desktop doesn't load right. Well, it could be one of two things. It could be the monitor or it could be the graphics card. Unless you also know that it saves that resolution information in the non-volatile RAM, which has a battery.
To remember.
So if it's an older machine, change the battery first.
Yep.
Then set your resolution, see what happens next time.
And it's probably a CR2032.
Because that's the battery. It's that coin size, that not quite quarter-sized battery that everybody uses. It's in watches, it's in everything. Yep. So unless it's a very old motherboard, in which case it's soldered, it's a barrel thing soldered onto the board. But
Apple used the 1/2 AA and a lot of their old computers.
Right.
Now they went to the CR2032.
Everybody's gone to the CR2032. If I had
you
only
give them
gotten,
a Wegmans.
If I had only gotten stock in that. So it's knowing the sequence of events that lead to something happening correctly, which tells you where you can go back in there to see how things, where things can go wrong earliest. And generally, earliest is cheapest. Sure, you could replace your monitor. Sure, you could replace your graphics card. But why not just replace the battery and see what happens?
Of course, knowing Bodin, he has other computers and other monitors. So
yeah, right.
Because we used
in
to say that.
In his case, it's not a big deal.
Take your computer to a friend's house, try their monitor and see what happens.
Right, right, right. And that's, of course, what I've always said about anything. It's not that you can't do the work. You don't have the tools.
Yeah.
You know, I can pull the fan off of the front of my car engine. However, it's a whole lot easier to take it to a garage and they use the fan puller.
Yeah.
Boom. It's off. Done. It's a pretty interesting situation that's going on there. And again, back to Python, easy language to learn. Like every language, it's got its little quirks and its little businesses, but it's an interpreted language. It's a very good language. You can do an amazing amount of stuff in it because it's a full-blown programming language. But also in Linux and probably in the Mac, you can have it do stuff in the background for you while you can write programs that act on their own in the background while stuff is going on. All right, we're going to take a quick break. However, we will be back in just a couple of minutes with Steve Ray, Michael Oden, me, Nick Francesco, and you. 20 minutes after the hour, plenty of time to call in, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 1-800-790-0415. We'll be back with a whole lot more of this nonsense on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Got a computer question? Call the boys now at 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299 or toll-free 800-790-0415. Online at soundbites.org. Soundbites continues next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Before you...
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Michael Oden.
And at 24 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbite. Our friend Joe over on the Google Hangout says the 2032 in CR2032 means 20 millimeter diameter, 3.2 millimeter thickness of the cell itself.
Wow.
And Jerry says that the CR means it's chrome lithium. It's a chrome lithium battery.
I love our audience.
There's also a BR cell that uses different materials.
Beryllium.
And a VL.
The beryllium sphere.
A VL. And a VL and a DL. We have way too many geeks who know everything about everything. This is one of the things I love most about this stuff. It's very fun.
Wikipedia. We have the entire knowledge of the world at our fingertips.
Yeah, but I'll bet you these people just knew it all off the top
probably,
of their heads.
Probably, yeah. I remember somebody did a study about the Encyclopedia Britannica versus Wikipedia. Wikipedia edged them out a little bit. There were slightly fewer errors, slightly more detail, and much more timely. I used to remember every month, was it every month? No, I think it was every year when I was a kid. We got an update to the Encyclopedia Britannica.
Yes, we did. But every year, the yearbook came out.
Yeah. But what happened last month? We got to wait till the end of the year till you get it.
Right.
Current events.
Did you know that they would write papers for you?
Research, yeah.
You would give them a topic, and they would write a paper on it for you. That was part of the service if you bought the encyclopedia.
Wow.
Yeah. I'm not going to tell you how I knew
that. If they still had that around, I'd be made for like the next 3 years.
Well, there's a lot of internet services that will do research for you.
Yeah, exactly.
And give you a research paper that, of course, you would just use for research.
Research.
So it's like that Rodney Dangerfield movie where this feels like a B. Get some more NASA scientists in here. And Kurt Vonnegut wrote his English essay, and the teacher got mad. I don't know who wrote this, but they didn't know anything about Kurt Vonnegut.
You're right. Speaking of phones, which we've been doing today, back in June, screenshots of an early Windows phone operating system build leaked via a Lumia phone allegedly purchased on eBay. At that time, next to no attention was paid to an app listed as Z Cortana that was on the phone. But that Cortana app, with the Z indicating it was a test build, is central to what Microsoft is doing to compete with Apple Siri and Google Now. And Cortana is back in the news this week with passing mentions by those tracking what's happening with the Windows phone as it moves toward the blue release in the early part of 2014. Those of you who are gamers know that Cortana takes its code name from Cortana, an artificially intelligent character in Microsoft's Halo series who can learn and adapt. Cortana, Microsoft's assistant technology, likewise will be able to learn and adapt, relying on machine learning technology and the Satori Knowledge Repository, which powers Bing. Bing! Cortana will be more than just an app that lets users interact with their phones more naturally using voice commands. Cortana is core to the makeover of the entire shell, the core services and experience of the future versions of Windows Phone, Windows, and the Xbox One operating systems. In Microsoft CEO Steve Ballmer's strategy memo from July about Microsoft's reorg, there were hints about Cortana. Ballmer mentioned that Microsoft will be working going forward on a family of devices powered by a service-enabled shell. That shell is more than just a Metro Modern tiled interface. Ballmer continued, "Our UI will be deeply personalized, based on the advanced, almost magical intelligence in our cloud that learns more and more over time about people and the world. Our shell will natively support all of our essential services and will be great at responding seamlessly to what people ask for and even anticipating what they need before they ask for it. The coming shell won't simply surface information stored on the user's phones, PCs, and consoles like a search engine can do today. It will also broker information among our services to bring them together on our devices in ways that will enable richer and deeper app experiences, Ballmer said in his memo. Microsoft execs, especially Ballmer, have been talking up Microsoft's plan to launch a new kind of personal assistant technology since 2011. At that time, Ballmer was touting publicly the idea that users would be able to tell their PCs to print my boarding pass on Southwest and have their systems automatically jump into action. The magic behind the scenes would be a combination of Microsoft Bing, tell me speech technology, and some natural language plus social graph concoction. Are you waiting for Cortana? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299, toll-free 1-800-790-0415. Just like GERD did in Victor, New York. Welcome, GERD. What's up?
Oh, it's always a pleasure to listen to you.
And a joy to hear from you. What can I do for you?
And I am a paid member, by the way.
That's what I like to hear.
Well, you should say that more often, because a lot of people would probably contribute.
I think you're absolutely right. We do have a lapse thing. Well, we have a
pledge drive.
Pledge drive coming up shortly.
Yeah, but you can intersperse it between. Okay, never mind. Here's the deal.
Yeah,
just got a 14-inch HP Chrome.
Ooh.
And
with the new Haswell chip.
I'm sorry?
With the new Haswell chip?
I don't have a clue.
Okay.
How do I connect that to my Lexmark printer Wi-Fi?
The printer, well, one of two ways. You have to do it through cloud printing. And you can do that in one of two ways. If the printer itself has cloud printing built in, and many of the newer ones do, but
not a new one.
Then you have to connect it to a computer, which you can then connect to Cloud Print, and then do it that way. If you have a desktop computer, for example,
yes, I do.
You can, and it's running Windows.
Yeah, XP.
Okay.
I'm looking at the requirements here too.
Yeah.
It's very.
Go ahead.
I was saying it's similar to the Apple's AirPrint feature that printer manufacturers are putting in, so you can print from an iPad.
Right. There is a Google support system a Google support page that will tell you how to do this, and we'll put that. You have to have XP Service Pack 3 installed.
That's my desktop. Yes,
yeah.
But I'm talking about how do I connect my.
Well, first you set up.
Well, the short answer is you don't. You don't connect the Chromebook to the printer wirelessly.
Oh.
The printer has to be connected to the computer, and the computer connected to the internet, and running the cloud print service.
And then you print from your Chromebook through the internet to your other computer, which prints it to the printer.
Doesn't sound too simple, does it?
It actually is fairly simple.
Or buy a new printer that has Cloud Print built in.
Right. But what happens is you install this little piece of software, you sign in to Google Cloud Print. Steve is going to put all these directions up. But it's really fairly simple. You sign into Google Cloud Print. You say, this is my Google Cloud printer. So from then on, anytime you go to print from your Chromebook, because you're using the same login ID, right?
Okay. Yep.
It just automatically sends it to the cloud, which sends it to the desktop, which sends it to the printer. It's essentially seamless. Once you've set it up, it's just a matter of print this, just like you would anything else, and it will print out on the printer.
And one of the weird things about doing it that way is you don't have to be home. Your Chromebook can be anywhere on the internet, and you say print, and it comes out of your printer at home. Ready and waiting for it.
But I still have to have my desktop on, though, right?
Yes. Well, if you don't, then it will wait in the cloud until you turn your desktop on.
Okay.
Right.
Are you going to put it online?
Yeah.
We have the instructions online, and I also
they're on the website.
I also posted a link to the Google's general Cloud Print site, which lists a lot of the printers that are already Cloud Print available. And it's pretty much any wireless printer made in the last year or two.
Yeah.
They're adding Google Cloud Print and Apple's AirPrint as well.
But seriously, who prints anymore?
I do.
Yeah.
I print every Friday so that I have the news on Saturday. But that's the only thing I print.
We're moving towards second screens now. So yeah, instead of having a piece of paper, you have that.
I have this thing called college where I have to report. I have to like print, you know, essays and papers and whatnot.
I don't understand that either. Email it to the teacher. I tell my students if you print it, you automatically drop a letter grade. I want things emailed to me. And they can send them in Word. They can send them in anything.
They're time stamped, and they can't say, "Well, I put it under your office door last week."
That's exactly right. You send it to me in email.
Yep.
Anyway, that's how to do it. You create a cloud ready. You create a cloud printer connection on your desktop, and then you print from your Chromebook.
Okay, I have a 93-year-old mother living in a senior living community, and there are things that I get online that I think might interest her, so I print it.
That's a good idea.
Yeah, and she loves it.
That's perfect.
One more thing.
Yeah.
Why do you wait until Saturday to put up your little questionnaire thing?
You mean the poll?
Yeah.
Because last week's poll gets a whole week. And then this week's poll will get a whole week.
So you don't start until, like, Saturday sometime?
Well, because I don't talk about the news item until Saturday.
Okay.
Right? So I've had too many people, when I used to put up, I have no idea what you're talking about, who would answer, like, Thursday night, I have no idea what you're talking about. Well, that's right, because I haven't talked about it until the show on Saturday. So I put it up at midnight on Saturday, and then people can... if they know what I'm talking about, they can answer it, or they just wait. But then I give them a whole week to vote in the poll, because many people download the podcast.
And then we talk about the results the next week.
Right.
Gotcha.
There you go.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Love your show.
Thanks.
Although last week's poll button is hiding a little more.
Is it now?
Yeah, it's not below the poll.
Where'd it go? I don't know. There it is.
It's hiding.
It's hiding. All right, back to the phone.
No, it's at the top now, poll archives.
There you go. See, oh, yeah, right up there at the top.
Poll it moved. Archives. What did you move it for?
Exactly. Because I hate you.
Yeah.
Happy now?
Move it back.
Our next caller is David from Spencerport. Welcome, David. What's up?
I have a laptop, and the hard drive seems to be dying. And the simple question is, I have some software on the laptop that was downloaded over the internet, and I'd have to pay for it again if I get another machine. If I put a new hard drive in this laptop, is there any way I can basically ghost the image of the old hard drive still use, you know, not have to do a backup and rebuy this other software?
It depends on how badly damaged it is, how far gone it's got.
Yeah, it's working, but my machine, what happens is I feel a lot of heat, and the machine shuts itself down periodically.
Well, that may not be the hard drive.
Yeah, I know. It could be the fan, and I haven't decided which it is yet. But I'm just trying to figure out if it is the hard drive.
You should get a backup hard drive immediately and copy all your data, yes.
Yeah, I know that. But it's more an issue of not needing to rebuy, which it was relatively cheap software, but it was a student version. And so it's something where I don't have the CD.
Right.
A lot of times you can download that again and then use the license code. They sent you an email if you still have that license code.
Yeah.
But, yeah, some software...
And sometimes you can find the license code in the software itself.
Right. You log back into your account that you bought it with, and the code may be there. But I've been seeing that more and more, where you download software. And you know, it's $20 for the software, and for $6, we'll send you a CD. Or we'll keep record of it to let you download it again.
Right. Yeah, they did have that option. It's some company that deals with the schools with National Instruments piece of software. So anyhow, my thought was, okay, you know, I'm capable of putting in a new hard drive. If I got a new hard drive and hooked it up to the currently working machine before it fails, would I be able to copy everything and just throw the hard drive in and run? Is there any software that would do that?
Norton makes a product called Ghost.
That's what I thought.
Yeah, and many hard drives come with, if you buy a retail kit, they'll come with a cloning type software to do that for you as well.
Okay.
The one problem you may run into, because this sounds like a particularly annoying piece of software, not its functionality, it's licensing. Some software keys itself to the hardware in your computer, like Windows itself and Microsoft programs will do this. So if you change the hard drive in your computer, it says, oh, hey, you're trying to steal me on another computer.
Yeah.
And you might have to get around that.
Speaking of that, when you put in the new hard drive, you may have to call Microsoft and tell them you've put in a new hard drive before they will allow you to use the software.
The Windows Genuine Advantage will pop up and think you're stealing the software on another computer.
Yeah. I kind of thought it was going to be what you told me, but I'm not up to speed on those stuff, so I figured I'd run it by you guys.
Yeah, no, you got it.
That's good.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks, yep. David. Good luck.
And we're seeing that more and more with digital app stores. Same thing on the Mac now. But at least on the Mac, anything you buy on Apple's App Store, you can download again for free. Unless the company pulls it. If it doesn't exist anymore, you can't download it again. So when you download something, make a backup copy. For sure.
Exactly.
Yeah.
All right. We are going to take a short hiatus here. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Steve Ray, Michael Oden, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It is 40 minutes after the hour, and you're listening to Soundbites on Member Supported, and that means you can become a member, Jazz 90.1. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Michael Oden.
And at 44 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites. And on the line, we have Doug. Where are you calling from, Doug?
I am calling from Rochester, New York.
Okay. What can we do for you?
I have a computer that has a little over 4 gigabytes remaining, and it's less than a year old. And I do a lot of photography, and I'll do a lot of photography this fall. And I'm trying to figure out what my options are as far as more storage.
Is it a laptop or a desktop?
It's a desktop. It's an Asus computer. It's less than a year old.
Okay, you have several choices.
Yeah, you can get a bigger internal hard drive, either as a second drive if you have the bay for it, or replacing the drive you have now. Or you can get an external drive and use that to store extra files on as well. Do you know how big your current hard drive is total capacity?
Well, it says available was 186 gigabytes.
Yeah, there should be a total capacity or total size, something like that. If it's like a 500 gigabyte or terabyte hard drive. But yeah, 186 186 megs left?
No, only 4. 4
megs left. 186. So it's a 200 meg drive.
4 meg left?
It says 4.25 GB remaining.
Oh, that's gigabytes remaining.
4 gigs remaining, right. But for a photographer,
yeah,
that's nothing.
Not much, yeah.
No, that's no, not at all.
Yeah. Internal drives are cheaper than external, but you have to install them yourself or pay someone to install them. So an external drive is often much more convenient to just plug in. It shows up as another letter or icon on your desktop. And then you save files there.
And there are a couple of different ways that you can connect an external drive. You can connect one via USB, which is slow, but very easy to hook up. You can put one directly on your network-attached storage. If you've got a router, for example, that came with your internet service, many of them have 4 ports on the back. Most people don't use all 4 of those ports. You may have one left. You could buy network attached storage, hook it directly to the network, and then that will transfer at the speed of your network internally, which is usually 100 meg or a gigabit. So,
although those are a little more expensive than a regular USB drive. If the computer is fairly new, a year or so older, it may have USB 3 on it, which is much faster than USB 2.
Right.
So, I'm not sure what it does. Yeah, it was November of last year when the other one died, and I took as much off the other computer and put it on this one so that, you know, I wouldn't lose what I had.
Right.
Of course.
Yep.
Of course. Many people are buying external drives now. So as Steve said, they come in all kinds of sizes, all kinds of speeds. As a photographer, if in particular this is your livelihood, you may want to think about two different ones.
Okay.
So you can back one up to the other.
Yeah, one for storage and one for backup. So you have a second copy of all your files in case the main drive fails.
Right, because right now you only have one copy of your files.
So if
you were to copy those all to the, let's say you bought an external drive of whatever sort, I don't care. You copy them to that drive, now you've got two copies, one on your hard drive, one in the backup drive. But any new stuff you add is only going to be on that backup drive, so you have no backup of that. So if you, at some point, it doesn't have to be today because these things are not terribly cheap, but if you were to buy a second one of those,
holy crap,
you could then have them on two separate things.
I just found Seagate's got a 3 terabyte external hard drive on sale for $120.
Holy crap.
3 terabytes. That's got to be a mistake.
How?
Click. Buy now.
How does it connect?
Is it
USB?
Looking. USB 3. Which is backward compatible to USB 2.
Right. The other thing many people are doing is putting it all in the cloud in some way, but that's a separate issue for a separate day. Right now, you have to decide whether or not you want to put it directly inside your machine, hook it up via USB, or hook it up via the network.
Okay.
But in any case, it is certainly doable. The easiest option is to buy an external USB drive, and if it takes a little while to copy, you honestly don't care.
Right. An internal drive would be a little faster, but that's a little more mucking about for you.
Right.
And the other issue that some people find confusion sometimes is now you have two drive letters. You'll have a C and, say, a D. And so when you want to save another file, you point it to D, which is now the new, bigger drive.
Right.
Okay. That makes sense. Yeah, what happens, I mean, I've got the Canon Zoom Browser program, which is a software that you know, takes your images from the camera or from the SD card.
Right.
And then I've got Picasa 3, which duplicates everything that the Canon is doing.
Right.
And then you've got My Pictures on the computer, which is like a third location for the same photographs.
Right,
and well, I'm trying to weed something out to at least make some room for now.
What may be happening is the My Pictures folder is where the pictures are physically on the drive, and the Canon Zoom software is just looking at that folder and showing you those pictures. It may not actually be there again. It may just be looking at that folder.
It depends on how you set it up. You can set it up to do pretty much anything, but you do have to set it up. If you just installed it and let it do its own thing, it most likely created its own set of folders.
Okay, yeah, that's, I'm sure, what I did.
Yeah.
Are there any places to take any courses on file management? Because, I mean, I'm honestly a very good photographer, but I only switched over to digital in 2009.
The damn book.
Digital damn book.
Digital Asset Management.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thedambook.com. it's specifically designed for photographers on how to manage their digital assets, their files and their photos. It's a physical printed book or a PDF, and they have some video tutorials on their site as well. And right on their homepage, they're talking about how to use Lightroom as an asset management. So that's similar to your Canon software that you're using now too.
But I would check that out if I were you.
Okay, awesome.
All right, thanks.
Well, thank you very much.
Yep.
Appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
As
always happens, we seem to have a whole bunch of people lined up for the last 4 minutes of the show. We'll get to as many of you as we can. No promises.
It's the lightning round.
It's the lightning round.
Just put them on the air. We'll get his name.
Yeah, we'll get their name on the air. Just put them up. All right, who's this?
This is Mark from Irondequoit.
Hi, Mark. What's up?
Okay, two quick questions, hopefully. I am interested in getting the new iPhone, so but I want to know, how do I wipe out my old one if I were to trade it in, and then so I'd be able to get all that information back on the new phone?
Well, first you want to back up your phone either to your computer or to iCloud, So you have a copy of all your stuff. And then in general, settings, general, about maybe, somewhere in there, there is a reset button that will reset the phone. Settings, general, the very bottom is reset. And one of the options is erase all content and settings. And so that wipes out all of your stuff on that phone. And then when you get your new phone, you say restore from your iCloud backup.
Right. And then, I think that makes sense. It's probably what I was thinking. And then I recently upgraded to an extreme internet service here from Time Warner. Excuse me for mentioning their name. But generally speaking, it works. We have no trouble streaming stuff from Netflix, whatever. But on my actual, I have an iMac, a couple years old now. I'll go to two or three sites, and then the fourth site seems to just slow down. And it doesn't matter like where I'm going. I can just like want to go back to Yahoo's homepage, and it just takes a while to load.
How much memory?
Any idea?
How much memory does your computer have?
I haven't upgraded it, but it's an iMac, first 27-inch model when they first came out with something like that. I don't know.
That's probably 4 gigs.
Unless I get.
Which should
I'm
be
on
enough.
It, but about this Mac.
Yeah, check about this Mac. You want to have
at
least
4 gigabyte of memory.
Yeah, so 4 should be enough. You could always add more. And you're using the Safari browser.
It also
Safari
depends on
browser.
How much else you're running.
Yeah, how many other things are running at the time. It might not hurt to clear the cache out of your browser. That can help.
Okay, I never thought of that.
Yep.
All right, well, you're helpful enough. Thanks, but the main thing is how to make sure I wipe out my phone and then
Especially if you're going to sell it to somebody else. You want to make sure that all of your stuff is gone.
The way I would do it, though, is the other direction. I'd buy the new phone, back up the old phone, buy the new phone, restore it.
Make sure the new phone is working.
Yeah, and then wipe out the old phone.
All right.
Just
either
in case.
Either way will work. So thank you very much.
Thanks.
Thank you very much. Okay, bye.
Yeah. All right, do we have another caller? No, excellent. Okay, good.
It's always annoying with web browsing. You know, page after page after page, and then you try to go back, and the cache can fill up, memory can fill up. So many websites have so many ads on them that it fills everything up on you.
Yeah. All right, we apparently are done for another week. I want to thank everybody who called in. I want to apologize to all those to whom we did not get. Please call earlier next week. And we'll be able to get you in. For Steve Ray, for Michael Oden, I'm Nick Francesco. You've been listening to Soundbites on member-supported, so become a member, Jazz 90.1.